You're sitting with someone you love, and you both know time is running out, but somehow you keep talking about everything except what matters most. If you find yourself filling the silence with weather updates and medication schedules, if you're lying awake at 3 in the morning, replaying all the conversations you haven't had, if you're terrified that you'll say the wrong thing and make their pain worse, or that you'll break down and burden them with your grief. If you're watching precious days slip past while everyone in the room pretends this isn't really happening. If you're already grieving the words you haven't said and fearing you'll carry that regret forever, then what I'm about to share with you matters more than you can imagine right now. You've probably tried dropping hints, hoping they'll open the door to deeper conversations. You've rehearsed what you want to say during long drives or in the shower, but when you're actually in the room together, those carefully prepared words evaporate. Maybe you've even started a serious conversation, only for them to change the subject or assure you they're fine, leaving you wondering if you should have pushed harder or if you did the right thing by backing off. Perhaps you've read articles about having the talk that made it sound simple, just be honest, just be present, but they didn't account for the complexity of your actual relationship, the old wounds that never healed, or the fact that your loved one might not want to talk at all. You might have tried being relentlessly positive, keeping every conversation light and hopeful, thinking that's what they need. Or maybe you've gone the opposite direction, trying to force honesty by directly asking about their fears and feelings, only to see them shut down completely. You've possibly sought advice from well-meaning friends who've never been through this, or even from those who have, but whose experience was so different from yours that their suggestions feel impossible to apply. And through it all, there's this exhausting performance everyone's maintaining, pretending things are normal, while the unspoken truth takes up all the oxygen in the room. Here's what I want you to understand. The reason those approaches haven't worked isn't because you're doing it wrong, or because your relationship is too damaged or too complicated. It's because no one ever taught you to build what I call a presence bridge, a way of connecting that doesn't require you to fix anything, doesn't demand that your loved one process their mortality on your timeline, and doesn't mean abandoning hope or pretending you're not devastated. In the next hour, I'm going to walk you through the exact presence bridge method that allows families to transform these final weeks from a minefield of regret into something unexpectedly sacred. You're going to learn how to create openings for deep conversation without forcing anything. You'll discover the specific types of questions that invite sharing without pressure. And just as importantly, you'll learn how to be together in meaningful silence when words aren't what's needed. I'll show you how to navigate the complicated dynamics, the family member who dominates every conversation, the loved one who insists they're fine when they're clearly not, the old resentments that keep surfacing at the worst possible times. You'll understand why being present actually means something quite different from what most people think, and how to do it even when you're drowning in your own anticipatory grief. I'm going to give you language for the conversations you're most afraid of, including how to offer forgiveness, ask for it, express gratitude, and say the things that matter without making it feel like a rehearsed goodbye. And perhaps most importantly, you'll learn how to read what your loved one actually needs in any given moment, rather than projecting what you need or what you think you're supposed to do. This isn't about having one perfect conversation. It's about building a bridge of presence and truth that you'll walk across together during whatever time remains, whether that's weeks or months, so that when you reach the other side, you'll carry peace instead of haunting questions. What I'm sharing with you has guided hundreds of families through this passage, and it works regardless of whether your relationship has been mostly loving or deeply complicated, whether your loved one is open to talking or highly resistant, Whether you have a strong support system or you're navigating this feeling utterly alone. But here's what I need from you. This method requires your full attention right now, in this moment. I know you're exhausted. I know part of you wants to listen to this while you're doing something else, while you're partially distracted, keeping one ear out for the monitor or the phone.
But these 70 minutes might be the most important investment you make in your remaining time together. So I'm asking you, if you're driving, wait until you can sit with this. If you're at the hospital, find a quiet corner or go to your car. If you're at home, tell others you need this hour uninterrupted. Get a notepad because you'll want to write some things down. What we're about to do together will change not only how you experience these final weeks, but how you carry this person with you for the rest of your life. Let's begin. You know what keeps people up at night after someone they love has died? It's not usually the big, dramatic things. It's the silence, the things left unsaid, the questions never asked, the love never fully expressed in those final weeks when it mattered most. And here's what makes this so painful. Most people believe they did the right thing by keeping quiet. They thought they were being strong. They thought they were protecting their loved one from fear or sadness. They believed that talking about death would somehow make it come faster or make the final days heavier. But that's exactly why the regret cuts so deep afterward. Let me explain what's really happening here, because once you understand this, everything changes. Most advice around end-of-life conversations tells you to just be there and make them comfortable. You'll hear things like, follow their lead, or don't force conversations they're not ready for. And look, that advice isn't wrong exactly. Presence matters. Comfort matters. Respecting boundaries matters. But here's what nobody tells you. This approach only addresses the surface of what's actually needed during those final weeks together. Being physically present while emotionally absent creates a different kind of loneliness, one that's somehow worse than being alone. Making someone physically comfortable while avoiding the conversations that would bring emotional and spiritual completion leaves everyone stranded on opposite sides of an invisible wall. The problem with just be there is it gives you permission to show up without actually connecting. It lets you sit in silence and call it respect, when sometimes that silence is actually fear wearing a disguise. Your dying loved one knows they're dying. They can feel it. And when everyone around them pretends otherwise, it doesn't protect them from that reality. It just makes them bear it alone. That incomplete approach fails because death isn't just a physical event. It's an emotional, spiritual, and relational transition. And transitions require communication, acknowledgement, and mutual understanding. You can't transition together in silence. But even when families know deep down that they need to talk, there's something bigger working against them. The real issue is that our entire healthcare system and cultural framework around dying are actively preventing these conversations from happening. Think about it. When someone is diagnosed with a terminal illness, what immediately happens? The system kicks into gear with treatment protocols, medication schedules, doctor appointments, insurance forms, symptom management. Everyone suddenly has a role: patient, caregiver, medical professional, and all those roles come with scripts, expectations, and unspoken rules about what you should and shouldn't discuss. The hospital room becomes a stage where everyone performs their assigned part. The dying person performs bravery, the family performs hope, the doctors perform expertise and clinical detachment, and nowhere in that production is there space for the raw, messy, essential conversations about what's actually happening before time runs out. Our culture has medicalized death to the point where we've lost the ability to simply be human with each other during it. We've replaced deathbed wisdom with treatment plans. We've substituted meaningful legacy conversations with insurance claims. We've traded emotional presence for caregiver tasks. The environment itself is working against you. hospital visiting hours that limit deep conversation, the parade of medical staff interrupting intimate moments, the exhaustion from caretaking that leaves no energy for emotional work, the family dynamics where everyone retreats to their habitual roles under stress, the well-meaning friends who say, "Stay positive," as if acknowledging reality is somehow betrayal. You're not just fighting your own fear and discomfort. You're fighting against an entire system designed to keep everyone busy, distracted, and focused on everything except the actual relationship and what needs to happen within it before time runs out. And when you do gather your courage to try to break through this system, when you decide you're going to have those real conversations, regardless of what's working against you, that's when you often run into an even more insidious problem.
When you try to force these conversations or push through the resistance, you actually make it worse. The moment feels pressured instead of sacred. Your loved one might shut down or redirect. Other family members might accuse you of being morbid or giving up hope, and then everyone retreats even further into their protective silence, and now there's also resentment and tension layered on top. This is the suppression trap. The harder you push against the collective denial, the stronger it pushes back. Because what you're really asking everyone to do is feel their grief while the person is still alive. You're asking them to acknowledge what they're about to lose before they've actually lost it. And that anticipatory grief feels unbearable to most people. So they suppress it. They change the subject. They focus on medication schedules and meal plans. They talk about anything except the elephant, not just in the room, but lying in the bed. And when you try to name that elephant, you become the problem. You become the person making everyone uncomfortable, forcing everyone to feel what they're working so hard not to feel. The suppression trap is cruel because it punishes exactly the person who's trying to create what everyone actually needs. Deep down, everyone wants those conversations. The dying person doesn't want to go unacknowledged. The family doesn't want to carry decades of regret. But the collective agreement to suppress what's real is so powerful that breaking it feels like breaking the family itself. And beneath all of this, beneath the incomplete advice and the systemic barriers and the suppression trap, there's something else operating, something invisible but incredibly powerful. I call it the silence spiral. Here's how it works. Someone in the family, maybe you, maybe your dying loved one, decides that the loving thing to do is protect everyone else from difficult feelings. Don't talk about being scared because it might scare them. Don't talk about regrets because it might burden them. Don't say goodbye because it might feel like giving up. Don't cry because it might make them cry. Don't acknowledge the ending because it might steal the joy from the remaining time. That's the initial decision, and it comes from genuine love and good intentions. But here's what happens next. That protective silence gets interpreted as a message: we don't talk about this. And then everyone else starts following that rule, also out of love and protection. Each person thinks they're shielding the others, but actually they're all just creating more distance. The silence feeds on itself. Days pass, weeks pass, and the gap between what's real and what anyone's willing to say grows wider. Important questions remain unasked. Essential words remain unspoken. Stories that need to be shared stay locked inside. Forgiveness that needs to be offered gets postponed. Love that needs to be articulated gets assumed but never declared. The silence spiral creates a tragic irony. In trying to protect each other, everyone ends up more alone. The dying person dies with their emotional and spiritual affairs unfinished. The family is left with a grief complicated by regret, by all those things they wish they'd said or asked, by the feeling that they failed at the one thing that mattered most in those final weeks. And here's the cruelest part. That regret doesn't fade. It compounds. It becomes a permanent feature of how you remember that person and that time. It affects how you grieve. It influences your other relationships. It can haunt you for decades. The silence spiral convinces everyone that protection equals love, when actually, the deepest love shows up as presence, truth, and courageous vulnerability even when it's uncomfortable. Until you recognize this pattern and actively work to break it, it will continue spinning, generating more distance and ensuring more regret, all in the name of love. This is what's really stealing the gift that those final weeks together could be. Now, let me introduce you to the Presence Bridge Method, a framework that's going to change everything about how you approach these precious remaining weeks and months together. Here's the insight that makes this different from everything else you've tried. The opposite of giving up hope isn't denying reality, it's creating sacred, meaningful moments within reality that become the foundation for healing grief and celebrating life simultaneously. You're not choosing between hope and honesty. You're not choosing between staying positive and being real. You're building something far more powerful, a bridge that lets you cross this impossible terrain together, holding hands the entire way. Think of it this way. Imagine a family standing together on a frozen lake. They're holding hands in a circle, trying to stay connected, but beneath them, the ice is cracking. Everyone can hear it, that sharp, unmistakable sound of something breaking apart.
But no one says anything, because acknowledging the cracking feels like giving up, feels like admitting defeat. So they stand there, pretending, getting more terrified by the second, each person isolated in their own private panic, even though they're physically touching. That's what most families do at the end of life. They hear the ice cracking, but the silence around it creates more fear than the reality itself. The Presence Bridge Method teaches you something completely different. It teaches you to acknowledge the cracking ice out loud, and then to build a sturdy footbridge together, not to stop the inevitable, but to cross safely to the other side while still holding hands. This ensures no one falls through alone and unheard. It transforms the crossing from a terrifying, isolating experience into something you navigate as a connected team. This isn't about managing death. It's about fully living until the last moment while simultaneously preparing for what comes after, both things at once. That's the bridge. The method has 6 essential steps, and I'm going to teach you each one in detail, because this is where transformation actually happens. We've structured it as an acronym: BRIDGE, break the silence, receive their truth, invite legacy moments, document the wisdom, grant permissions, express gratitude. Each step builds on the last, creating a framework that holds you when nothing else can. Let's start with the first step. Break the silence with one honest permission statement. This is where most people get stuck before they even begin. You want to have real conversations, but you don't know how to start. You're afraid of upsetting your loved one, afraid of saying the wrong thing, afraid of taking away hope. So you wait for the perfect moment, the perfect words, and that moment never comes. Here's what actually works. One honest permission statement. That's it. You don't need a long, perfectly crafted speech. You don't need to have all the answers. You just need one sentence that breaks through the pretense and creates space for truth. It sounds like this: I want us to talk about what matters most, even if it's hard. Or, I don't want us to waste our remaining time pretending everything is fine when we both know it isn't. Or, I'm scared to bring this up, but I'm more scared of running out of time without saying what needs to be said. Notice what these statements do. They're vulnerable. They acknowledge difficulty. They give permission for honesty without forcing a specific topic. And critically, they come from your need for connection, not from an agenda to make your loved one face death before they're ready. Here's a real example of how this plays out. Jennifer had been visiting her father in the hospital for 3 weeks. Every conversation stayed relentlessly surface level. How's the food? Did you sleep? The nurse is nice, isn't she? Both of them knew his prognosis was poor, but neither would say it. Jennifer would drive home after each visit, feeling like she was wasting precious time, but she didn't know how to shift the dynamic. Finally, she used a break statement. She sat down, took her father's hand, and said, "Dad, I want us to talk about what really matters, even if it's hard. I don't want to look back and wish I'd been braver." Her father was quiet for a long moment. Then he said, "I've been wanting to talk to you about so many things, but I didn't want to burden you." That's what happens when you break the silence. You discover the other person was often waiting too, trapped in the same fear, relieved when someone finally opens the door. Now, the break statement won't always lead to an immediate deep conversation. Sometimes your loved one will say, "I'm not ready to talk about that yet." That's okay. You've planted a seed. You've created an opening. Try again another day with a gentler version. "I'm here whenever you want to talk about anything. Nothing is off limits for me." The goal isn't to force disclosure. It's to end the exhausting pretense that takes more energy than honesty. Which brings us to the second step: receive their truth without fixing, minimizing, or redirecting. This is harder than it sounds, because when someone you love is dying, your instinct is to make it better, to fix it, to find the silver lining, to redirect toward hope. But here's what you need to understand. In these conversations, your job isn't to fix or improve or reframe. Your job is to witness, to receive, to let their truth land without deflecting it. The most powerful phrase you can learn is, "Tell me more." When your loved one says something difficult, something that breaks your heart, something that feels unbearable, resist the urge to rush in with reassurance. Instead, lean in. "Tell me more about that," or simply, "I'm listening." Let me show you what this looks like in practice. David's mother said to him, "I'm so afraid of what will happen to you after I'm gone.
You've always needed me." David's instinct was to say, "Mom, I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. You need to focus on yourself." That's natural, right? But watch what happens if he receives her truth instead. "Tell me more, Mom. What are you most worried about?" "I worry you won't take care of yourself, that you'll stop eating properly, that you'll be lonely." "Tell me more." "I worry that I'll be forgotten, that after a while, it'll be like I was never here." "Mom, I need you to know that's not possible. Tell me what you want me to remember most." Do you see the difference? By receiving instead of deflecting, David created space for his mother to express her deepest fears. And once those fears were spoken and witnessed, they could actually address them together. They could make plans. They could create legacy moments around the very things she feared most. But none of that happens if he shuts down the conversation with premature reassurance. Receiving means tolerating your own discomfort. It means sitting with pain without rushing to resolution. It means trusting that being heard is more healing than being reassured. Practice saying these phrases. "That sounds really hard. I'm here. I want to understand. What else?" And the most powerful of all, "Tell me more." One warning here: receiving doesn't mean you have no boundaries. If your loved one is sharing in ways that feel abusive or manipulative, you can still protect yourself. But most of the time, what feels unbearable is simply raw truth. Let it be raw. The rawness is where healing lives. The third step is invite legacy moments by asking the questions that unlock meaning. Once you've broken the silence and created space for truth, you need to intentionally invite the moments that will become the foundation of your healing after they're gone. These aren't just nice memories. These are carefully crafted moments of transmission where your loved one passes along what matters most. The two essential questions are, what do you want us to remember about you? And what needs to be said? These questions work because they're open-ended and future-focused. They acknowledge that this person's life has meaning that extends beyond their death. They invite storytelling, wisdom sharing, and completion. Here's how you use them. During a quiet moment together, ask, Mom, what do you want us to remember about you? Not just the big things, but the small things too. This opens the door for stories, for values, for the essence of who they are. Your mother might talk about how she always tried to find beauty in ordinary moments, how she believed in second chances, how she made the best lemon cake in 3 counties. These aren't just facts. These are invitations for you to carry her forward. Follow up with specifics. What do you want me to remember about how you loved me? What do you want your grandchildren to know about how you lived? What was most important to you in this life? The second question, what needs to be said, creates space for completion, for apologies, for forgiveness, for the things that have been held back for years or decades. You might ask your father, Dad, is there anything that needs to be said between us? Anything left unfinished? Sometimes the answer is simple, just that I love you, that I'm proud of you. Sometimes the answer is more complicated. I need to apologize for how angry I was when you were growing up. Either way, you've created the container for it to emerge. Here's what this looked like for Maria. She asked her dying husband, "What do you want the kids to know about how to live?" Over several conversations, he shared stories about risk-taking, about choosing adventure over security, about the importance of telling people you love them. Maria recorded these conversations. After he died, she transcribed them into letters for each child to receive on their 18th birthday. Those letters became a living legacy, guidance from beyond the grave that shaped how her children moved through the world. That only happened because Maria asked the inviting question and then created space for the answer to unfold. Don't rush this step. You might ask an inviting question and get a short answer. That's okay. Come back to it the next day. You mentioned yesterday that you want us to remember how you loved adventure. Tell me a story about that. Keep inviting. Keep creating space. The legacy emerges through accumulated moments, not one perfect conversation. Step 4. Document the wisdom, stories, and love in their own words. This is the step people most often skip, and it's the one they most regret skipping. You think you'll remember. You won't. Not clearly. Not in their voice. Not with the specific details that make it precious. Documentation isn't about creating a perfect archive. It's about capturing their essence while they're still here to share it. You have options depending on your loved one's condition and preferences. Audio recordings are often the least intrusive. During a good conversation, you can simply have your phone recording. Later, you'll treasure hearing their voice, their laugh, their specific way of telling a story. Video adds another dimension, capturing expressions and presence, but it can feel more invasive. Some people get self-conscious on video. Use your judgment. Written letters or messages work beautifully when your loved one has the energy and ability to write. You might suggest, would you be willing to write a letter to each of the grandkids, just telling them what you want them to know? Even a few paragraphs becomes treasure. Some families create structured opportunities. They set up a story interview where one person asks questions while another records. Questions like, what was your childhood like? How did you meet mom? What was your greatest adventure? What did you learn about love? What are you most proud of? What do you wish you'd done differently? What advice would you give us? The key is making documentation feel natural, not clinical. You're not conducting a deposition. You're capturing love. Let me tell you about Robert's family. When Robert's mother was dying, his sister suggested they each spend an afternoon alone with her, asking questions and recording the conversations. Robert was skeptical. It felt too formal, too much like acknowledging she was dying. But he did it anyway.
He asked his mother about her parents, about growing up during the Depression, about what she hoped for when she got married, about what it was like raising four kids. He asked what she was proud of, what she regretted, what she believed about God and death and what comes after. The conversation lasted 2 hours. His mother was tired afterward, but glowing. "Thank you for asking," she told him. "No one ever asks." Robert has listened to that recording probably 50 times in the 5 years since she died. When he misses her voice, when he needs advice, when he wants to feel connected, that 2-hour conversation became an inexhaustible well of comfort. You might be thinking, what if my loved one isn't coherent enough for this? What if they're too sick? Then you adapt. Even fragments are precious. You might capture a single sentence, a blessing, a "I love you" in their voice. You might document your own memories of what they said before they got sick. You might gather siblings and share stories among yourselves, recording the group conversation. Any documentation is better than none. And here's something unexpected. The act of documenting changes the quality of your presence. When you know you're capturing something for the future, you listen differently. You're more present, more attentive. The documentation itself becomes a gift to both of you. Step 5. Grant explicit permissions, both ways. This might be the most powerful step in the entire method, and it's the one that most directly addresses the silent suffering that happens at the end of life. Both the dying person and the family members need explicit permission, and neither can move forward in peace until they receive it. Your dying loved one needs permission to let go. Despite what you see in movies, many people can't die peacefully while they're worried about the people they're leaving behind. They hold on, sometimes far longer than their body can sustain, because they feel responsible for protecting you from grief. This is where you need to be explicit. "Mom, it's okay to let go when you're ready. We will be sad, but we will be okay. You've taught us how to be okay. You don't need to stay for us." Or, "Dad, you've taken care of us your whole life. You've given us everything we need. It's okay to rest now. We've got each other. We'll take care of Mom. You can let go." This is not giving up. This is releasing someone you love from the burden of worrying about you in their final moments. It's one of the most loving things you can do. But permission needs to go both ways. You need explicit permission from them to keep living fully after they're gone. This sounds obvious, but it's not. Many people get stuck in grief because they unconsciously believe that moving forward means forgetting, that healing means betrayal, that joy after loss means the person didn't matter enough. Your loved one can prevent this by giving you explicit permission. "I want you to be happy after I'm gone. I want you to laugh and fall in love again and travel and do all the things you've dreamed of. That's not betraying me. That's honoring me." You can invite this by asking, "What do you want for us after you're gone? What kind of life do you hope we'll live?"
When Sarah's husband was dying, he made her promise 3 things: that she would keep going to their favorite restaurant, that she would eventually date again, and that she would take the trip to Italy they'd always planned, even if she had to go alone or with a friend. Those permissions became the roadmap for her healing. Every time she felt guilty for experiencing joy, she remembered, "He wanted this for me. This honors him, doesn't betray him." Permissions can be specific. "I want you to sell the house if it becomes too much. I don't want you trapped by it. I want you to spend the life insurance on something that brings you joy, not just bills. I want you to let the grandkids make mistakes. Don't try to control everything." Or permissions can be general. "Live fully. Don't let grief stop you from becoming who you're meant to be." Either way, when these permissions are spoken out loud, witnessed, and ideally documented, they become an anchor. They free both parties to navigate what's coming without being trapped by guilt or obligation. The final step is express gratitude and love specifically and repeatedly through daily acknowledgement rituals. Here is what most people do at the end of life. They say, "I love you," a lot, which is beautiful. But generic love declarations, while important, don't carry the weight of specific gratitude, and it's the specific gratitude that heals regret and creates completeness. Instead of just, "I love you," practice saying, "I love you because," or "I'm grateful for." "Dad, I'm grateful for all the times you showed up at my games, even when you were exhausted from work. That taught me what commitment looks like." "Mom, I love how you always found a reason to celebrate. You taught me that life is worth honoring, even in small ways." "I'm grateful for how you loved me through that really difficult time when I was 23 and making terrible choices. You never gave up on me." This specificity does two things. First, it tells your loved one exactly how they mattered. They get to hear the impact they had, the ways they shaped you, the legacy that will outlive them. Second, it rewires your own brain. You're training yourself to notice and name what you're grateful for, which becomes the foundation for how you'll remember them after they're gone. Create a daily practice of this. Every visit, every phone call, share one specific thing you're grateful for. It can be from the distant past or from that very day. "I'm grateful you told me that story about Grandma today. I'd never heard that before." "I'm grateful for how you always made me feel like I was your favorite, even though I know you did that for all of us." Some families ritualize this. They gather every evening before the dying person goes to sleep, and each family member shares one gratitude. It takes 5 minutes. It transforms the day from medical management to meaning making. You can also ritualize love expression. One family created a practice where they would each tell their dying mother one reason she was irreplaceable. "You're irreplaceable because you saw the best in me, even when I couldn't see it myself." "You're irreplaceable because your laughter was the soundtrack of my childhood." These rituals serve another crucial purpose. They give you something to do. When you feel helpless in the face of death, having a concrete daily practice creates a sense of purpose. You're not just waiting for death. You're actively building something together in the time that remains. Now, let's talk about the obstacles you're going to face as you try to implement this method, because knowing the obstacles in advance helps you navigate them. The first obstacle is, "My loved one won't engage. They refuse to have these conversations." This is real, and it's painful. You can't force someone to participate in their own legacy building. But here's what you can do. Start smaller. Don't lead with the big conversations. Start with step 6, daily specific gratitude. Just share what you're grateful for, without asking for anything in return. Create safety through your own vulnerability. Over time, this often opens doors. And if it doesn't, you do what you can. You document your memories. You write letters to them expressing what you needed to say, even if they can't or won't respond. You build your own bridge, even if they're not standing on it with you. Second obstacle, "I don't have much time. They're already very close to death." Then you compress the timeline. You might do all 6 steps in one conversation. "Dad, I need to tell you what you've meant to me. I need you to know you can let go. I need you to tell me what you want me to remember." You can do a version of this method even in the final hours or days. It won't be as complete as having weeks or months, but it's profoundly better than nothing. Third obstacle, "I'm too emotional. Every time I try to have these conversations, I break down crying." Here's the truth. Crying is not failure. Your tears communicate love. They show that this matters. Don't apologize for them. But if you genuinely can't get words out, write them, send a letter or email, record a voice memo and play it for them. Use whatever medium allows you to express what needs to be expressed. Fourth obstacle, "My family thinks I'm being morbid or negative. They're sabotaging my attempts to have real conversations." This is where you need to be both gentle and firm. Explain the difference between giving up hope and creating meaning. Share the bridge metaphor.
Say, I'm not trying to make everyone depressed. I'm trying to make sure we don't have regrets. I need this, even if you're not ready yet. I won't force you to participate, but I'm asking you not to prevent me from connecting in the way I need to. Fifth obstacle. I'm afraid I'll say the wrong thing and cause harm. You probably won't, but even if you do, you can repair it. The much greater harm is silence. If you say something that lands wrong, you apologize and try again. I'm sorry, what I meant to say was... The courage to keep trying is more important than perfect execution. So why does this method work when so many other approaches fail? It works because it addresses the core problem, the unbearable loneliness of unwitnessed dying and unprocessed grief. When someone dies and the people around them couldn't speak truthfully, couldn't say what needed to be said, couldn't receive the wisdom that was available, the grief becomes complicated. It gets stuck. It turns into regret and guilt and unresolved longing. The presence bridge method prevents this by creating completion while the person is still alive. By the time death comes, you've said what needed to be said. You've received their truth. You've documented their wisdom. You've given and received permission. You've expressed specific love and gratitude. Death is still devastating, but it's not compounded by all the things you wish you'd done differently. This method also works because it shifts the final weeks from passive waiting to active creation. You're not just managing symptoms and counting down. You're building something together. Every conversation, every documented story, every expression of gratitude is a brick in the bridge that will carry you forward after they're gone. And finally, it works because it gives you both a role. Your dying loved one gets to be the author of their own legacy, not a victim of their disease. They get to teach, to share, to complete, and you get to be a witness, a receiver, a sacred container for their wisdom. Both of you have agency. Both of you have purpose. That transforms everything. So you've learned the presence bridge method. You understand how sacred small moments become, how to open conversation doors, and how to hold both truth and hope in the same breath. Now it's time to put this into practice, to become the conscious companion you're meant to be in this chapter. And here's what's beautiful about this approach. You don't need to wait for the perfect moment. You don't need more training or more courage than you have right now. You can begin immediately, even while you're listening to these words. Right now, wherever you are, I want you to take out your phone or find a piece of paper. Write down the name of your person, just their name, and underneath it, write one question you've been afraid to ask them. Not the hardest question, not the most profound one, just one question that's been sitting in your heart, waiting. It might be something about their childhood. It might be what they're most proud of. It might be whether they're scared. Write it down. This is your first bridge. Within the next few hours, today, you're going to practice the arrival ritual. Before you walk into their room or their home, you're going to pause for 30 seconds. You're going to put down your phone, take 3 breaths, and release the agenda you brought with you. You're going to step across that threshold as someone fully present, not as someone managing a crisis. And here's your first small conversation. You're simply going to tell them something you noticed, not something medical, something human. I noticed the light coming through your window this morning was beautiful. I noticed you smiled when you were talking about your garden yesterday. You're building your observation muscle. You're showing up as a noticer, not just a caretaker. Tomorrow, you're going to introduce what I call the daily question. Every day, for the rest of this journey, you're going to ask your person one meaningful question. Just one, and you're going to write down their answer afterward, even if it's just a sentence or two in your phone. This becomes your practice ground for the presence bridge method. Start with easier questions. What made you laugh hardest as a kid? What smell reminds you most of home? Who taught you to love? You're not conducting an interview. You're opening doors and seeing which ones they want to walk through with you. Some days they'll give you one sentence. Other days, that question will lead to an hour-long conversation that becomes one of your most precious memories. Both outcomes are perfect. Also, tomorrow, you're going to create what I call your comfort inventory. This is a simple list you keep on your phone of all the things that bring your person comfort or joy. The specific cookies they love, the old song that makes them smile, the story they like hearing about themselves, the way they prefer their pillows arranged, the time of day they feel most like talking. You're becoming a student of their comfort, and this list becomes your guide for all those moments when you want to do something but don't know what. Over the next week, days 2 through 7, you're going to practice all three elements of the Presence Bridge method in rotation. On day 2, focus on sacred ordinary moments. Practice your arrival ritual. Bring small delights. Protect their normal. Really notice what's happening in the small spaces. On day 3, focus on conversation architecture. Ask better questions. Sit with the silence. Follow their lead on how deep to go. On day 4, practice the authentic balance. When something is hard, name it. When they share fear, acknowledge it. When there's something to appreciate, say it out loud. On days 5, 6, and 7, you're weaving all three together, finding your rhythm with this approach. During this first week, you're also going to do something that might feel strange, but will change everything. You're going to start talking to yourself like you talk to someone you're coaching. When you catch yourself thinking, "I should be doing more," you're going to say out loud, "I am showing up with presence, and that is enough." When you feel guilty for laughing with them, you're going to remind yourself, joy and grief can coexist here. When you're exhausted, you're going to say, taking care of myself is part of taking care of them. You're building your conscious companion identity through the words you speak to yourself. One specific practice for this week: every evening, take 5 minutes to write down 3 specific moments from the day. Not summaries, actual moments. The way they looked at you when you brought their coffee, what they said about the weather, how their hand felt in yours. You're training yourself to capture the details that will matter desperately later. By day 30, you will be a different person. Not because 30 days is a magic number, but because 30 days of practiced presence changes how you show up in the world. You'll walk into their space and automatically do your arrival ritual without thinking about it. You'll naturally notice the small things that matter. You'll ask questions that create connection instead of just filling air. You'll hold hard truths and tender moments in the same conversation without falling apart. You'll have a growing collection of memories you're actively creating, not just passively receiving. And most importantly, you'll know in your bones that you're doing this right, that your presence is the gift, that you're building something that will carry you both through whatever comes next. You are becoming the conscious companion. Not someone who has all the answers or never struggles, but someone who shows up fully, who chooses presence over perfection, who creates bridges instead of waiting for them to appear. Start now. Ask that first question today. You know what happens next. And when you need a reminder, come back and listen again. This method works every time you work it.